Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at mathworks.com.
On Point is a production of NPR and WBUR Boston. The program is made possible by your financial support. Please pledge online at WBUR.org.
From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Absolute rage at Israel and the United States across the Middle East this weekend as Israeli bombs killed scores of civilians, many children, in Qana, Lebanon. The strain on the faces of George Bush and Condoleezza Rice, evident. The strain on American relations with old allies and friendly governments in the Arab world, huge, maybe near a breaking point. There are desperate, angry calls for an immediate ceasefire and determined, angry calls for more bloody war. Where America's real long-term interest lies on this smoking battlefield is the subject of urgent debate. Up next on Point, we'll hear it. Debating the way forward in the Middle East and what America should do now. We'll be joined in a moment by, among others, former Undersecretary of State Thomas Pickering. But first, joining me now from a stopover in Shannon, Ireland, is Robin Wright, diplomatic correspondent for The Washington Post. She's traveling with Secretary of State Condoleezza Rice. Robin, thank you for joining us. What is the Secretary of State saying about what has and has not been accomplished?
Well, Rice believes that over the next week we are likely to see a sequence of three events. The first is a resolution at the United Nations Security Council that will outline the framework for a ceasefire. The second will be the ceasefire itself, and the third will be the almost simultaneously deployment of a international stabilization force that will first try to help with humanitarian issues and then turn to the broader task of supporting the Lebanese army, supporting the Lebanese government as it tries to extend its authority throughout Lebanon.
Are there ceasefire terms that Condoleezza Rice is describing likely to be acceptable to either Israel or Hezbollah?
Well, that, of course, is a big question, and we have been pressing her on this, how there is any confidence that Hezbollah, which really has its entire existence as a militia, the last private army in Lebanon, riding on the outcome here, has any incentive at all to go along with a ceasefire, which would mean eventually disarming. There is some belief that there is a movement toward settling something called Sheba Farms. It is the last area that is disputed between the Israeli and Lebanese border. The Prime Minister of Lebanon has made this a very important issue, hoping that they can get some kind of concession from Israel on this, so that will then give Hezbollah no excuse for arguing that it should continue to have weaponry.
And what about Israel? The Justice Minister saying there that the offensive must go on until Hezbollah has no more abilities to attack Israel from South Lebanon. The Secretary of the Army there expressing similar sentiments. Is Israel prepared to participate in a ceasefire?
Well, one of the things that the Prime Minister of Israel told Rice while she was in Jerusalem was that Israel wanted 10 to 14 more days to carry out its military campaign. It's unclear if there is a resolution this week at the Security Council whether Israel will be willing to give up its campaign. The United States was heartened by the fact that the Israelis agreed to a suspension of aerial strikes on South Lebanon, except when they perceive that they are about to be targeted, which has happened already today. It was kind of short-lived. But the U.S. insists that the air suspension is still in place for 48 hours, and they hope that will change the dynamics on the ground and that will continue to be in place to kind of ease the level of missile strikes and airstrikes between the two warring parties.
Robin, you've been traveling with Condoleezza Rice. You write that she appeared shaken by news of the substantial civilian deaths in Qana, Lebanon, yesterday after Israeli airstrikes. Describe that for us.
Well, she came down and gave us a briefing at noon after the first pictures and the first news of Qana came out. She was really taken aback by this because she was in the midst of a meeting with the defense minister when one of her aides pulled her aside and told her about an email that they had been sent to them from the U.S. Embassy in Beirut describing the scope of what happened and the number of civilian casualties. This was the first time a woman who is very stoic when she appears in public and very tough and controlled in her language, appeared very moved and pained by what had happened. One of her aides described her as sickened by the pictures and by the news of the number, particularly the number of children who had died. And so clearly has been a bit of a catalyst in moving things along a little bit, and clearly contributed to the concession from Israel on the suspension of air activity or airstrikes.
Why didn't the Israelis inform her of that strike and its results? Or did they? She was meeting with the head of the army there.
Well, she was meeting with the defense minister.
Defense minister, excuse me.
She'd actually had breakfast with the foreign minister, and she was in the midst of this meeting with the defense minister. Neither of them mentioned it, and she then turned once she had the information and said to the defense minister, "What is this?" And he said he would look into it. And during the day, she had at least two conversations with Israeli officials who said that this was a site where the Hezbollah had deployed rockets and therefore was a justifiable target.
And the secretary, as she comes back to Washington, do you see this as genuine optimism, or is this a face that Washington has to put on a very tough situation? Do you think she really believes she'll have a ceasefire by the middle of this week?
Well, it certainly is very difficult looking at the dire situation on the ground and from the news out of Lebanon today. But she seems to be confident that there is genuine movement for the first time, that there is more of an interest. There are enormous questions, and frankly, I would think that there are more questions than answers at the moment. There's likely to be a bit of a bruising battle at the Security Council because there are very, very different versions of a Security Council resolution that different countries want to put forward for a vote. France, for example, is looking for an immediate ceasefire, and the United States wants something that has a broader package in it before there's a vote. So that in itself is going to be an interesting. And then, of course, trying to figure out what troops are going to get there this quickly. We were all rather stunned to hear talk of, you know, virtual simultaneous deployment of troops, which would mean sometime in the next week. And it takes a long time to get troops into a place with their equipment, their weapons, their cars, and so forth. So much less defining their very volatile mandate. Hezbollah will not have been disarmed by by this scenario.
These troops, of course, in the talk of an international force going in, part of Condoleezza Rice's vision for what should emerge here. Robin Wright, traveling with the Secretary of State, joining us on the way back home from Shannon Airport in Ireland. Robin, thank you very much for being with us.
Thank you.
Joining me now from Front Royal, Virginia, is Ambassador Thomas Pickering. He was Ambassador to the United Nations from 89 to 93, was Under Secretary of State for Political Affairs 97 to 2001, former Ambassador to, among many other nations, Israel. He held the rank of Career Ambassador, the highest rank in the American Diplomatic Corps. Thomas Pickering, thank you very much for joining us.
Tom, thank you, and it's nice to be with you.
Give us your sense. You know this region very well. The images over the weekend were stunning, first in the civilian death and then in the very widespread appearance of rage in the Middle East toward Israel and the United States. Condoleezza Rice says she's going to have a ceasefire maybe by the middle of this week. Do you believe it? Are we on the right track here? Have we been with this slow walking toward a ceasefire?
Well, much of this has been predictable and is predictable on the basis of past experience in the region. The question of a ceasefire this week or not is a highly problematic one. I wish Secretary Rice very good luck in her endeavors to do it. I would have hoped, in fact, that she'd been slightly more ahead of the present timescale, given the tragedy in Khana yesterday and our pressure for a ceasefire. Israel thinks it's going to need more time. What we sense, at least as we watched it from some distance, is the declining effectiveness of Israeli military attacks on the ground and in the air to reduce the capacity of Hezbollah to attack Israel. This is, of course, tragic, but it's a reality that has to be lived with. We see some interest in Hezbollah, and we see some interest in certainly Lebanon, which is dire need of a ceasefire in moving that ahead, and there seems to be a conjunction of views in the Security Council. I would have, frankly, Tom, that there'd been more pressure on Syria. Syria has a key on the Hezbollah thing than I think we have allowed up until now. I hope we're talking privately with Syria, but I would like to see more pressure moving there. And then finally, one other point in the introductory comment. I think there are two other interconnected and interrelated issues of great importance that will need attention. that in effect Lebanon is drawing attention away from the major effort which the United States has been making as a matter of priority to deal with Iran's nuclear weapons. And Iran is certainly supportive of Hezbollah, if not behind the move to get them into the conflict. And secondly, Hamas, the Palestinian Authority, and Israel all have this ongoing traumatic 50-year problem of what to do in an Arab-Israeli peace settlement. Some think it may be foolish, but my view is there is an opportunity here coming out of all of this challenge and tragedy to help also increase the pressure on these two issues.
Joined right now from Washington by Dr. Daniel Gouray, Vice President of the Lexington Institute, worked at the Pentagon under Donald Rumsfeld 2001-2003 as Director of the Office of Strategic Competitiveness. Daniel Gouray, thank you for joining us.
My pleasure.
Here we are, kind of fork in the road. Do we support Israel as for it to go root and branch after Hezbollah, or, as Condoleezza Rice is suggesting, do we go to the United Nations this week and urgently push for a ceasefire? How do you see it?
I think that this is a situation where it is necessary to destroy as much of Hezbollah as possible. And whether that takes, as the Israelis say, another 10 to 14 days, or it can be done through the interpositioning of international forces that essentially neutralize Hezbollah as a threat to Israel, it doesn't much matter. I would suggest, though, that I doubt that the international community is going to be able to pony up the forces necessary in the time span we're talking about. And as a result, I think this conflict will continue.
How do you read, you saw, as everyone did over the weekend, the bombing, the civilian deaths there, the scenes of rage around the Middle East. On the one hand, you have the very real rockets of Hezbollah raining into Israel and the notion that those have to be cleaned up. On the other, the fear that we're turning a whole region against the United States, maybe for a generation or more, and facing a real strategic setback there. How do you balance those two?
Well, it's extremely difficult, but what I find interesting is that for, 3 weeks now, most of the international community, including many states in the Middle East, were rooting for Israel, or at least were muting their criticism, even though we know that civilian areas were being targeted from the first day. And one could have expected that this kind of an incident was bound to happen. Children have been killed in this conflict. So we're really dealing with a very complex situation. The new factor in this environment, it's no longer about Palestinians and Israelis. It is now about radical Islam, Islamofascism, the Shia of supported by Iran. That's added a new dimension which scares the living daylights out of many in the region as well as in Europe and the United States.
But you've said we, including the United States, are effectively at war here and need to pick up the gauntlet and go at it whole hog. You said we're on the edge of World War III. This is the battle for all the marbles.
Look, it really is. I mean, we're in a situation now where you have Iran about to acquire nuclear weapons through Syria and Hezbollah and other groups, essentially manipulating a conflict across the region. This is a shadow that's now being cast ever wider across the region. The consequences of allowing this force to continue to thrive, to develop additional military capabilities across the spectrum, is in fact a regional-wide, perhaps worldwide conflagration. It needs to be stopped now.
Ambassador Pickering, there's the view. This is the beginning of a potentially worldwide conflagration. This is for all the marbles. This is no time for papering things over, for a ceasefire that doesn't solve the issue. What do you make of that perspective? Is this the time to get out the guns and go at it?
I don't think so. I think we're already pretty well extended in Iraq and Afghanistan. And if it is as cataclysmic as Mr. Bore says, then we will have to become involved. I don't think we're there. I do think we're already seeing signs the rest of the international community is concerned by the blow-up. I was prepared to play a role. I do agree with him that it would be nice if Israel could disarm Hezbollah. I don't think that's in the cards as we see it now. And I think greater time will risk the other point that he made, which I think is cogent. A number of the important Sunni Arabs have been with us, but over the last 4 or 5 days, they've begun to drop rapidly off the bandwagon. They're going to be important players in the aftermath of this particular effort. And in the aftermath of this effort, we're going to need them. And that's another important reason, I believe, to push for a ceasefire now, so that the diplomacy can be set for the future.
Daniel Goreg suggests that, you know, it's time to get into it and mix it up here. How do you see it, Ambassador? Do you see American interests as having been advanced in the last two or three weeks or having been set back?
I see them, unfortunately, as having been set back because the proximate cause for this conflict has not been America's fault, except perhaps because we left the Middle East alone for too long a period of time. I'm a believer in the bicycle principle. If you're not riding forward in the Middle East, you're falling down, and there's some of that there. I don't think, however, that military conflicts have solved anything in the Middle East. The best of them have set up the game plan for the strategic use of diplomacy, as we did in Madrid after the 82 conflict and the 1991 expulsion of Iraq from Kuwait, and we can see other opportunities there. So I would look more to the diplomacy than I would look to the military field, even though in this particular case, Israel's defense of itself has been essential. We need now to see whether, in fact, there's something that more can be done. And an interesting sign is Israel's willingness to agree to at least a limited 48-hour truce with some caveats.
Daniel Goreg, there's a perspective that says, hey, settle down, get a grip. You're not going to win this by the gun. In fact, we've been set back in the last 2 weeks. Let's get back on the diplomatic bicycle here. It's the only way to keep things moving forward. What do you say?
I don't think they're mutually exclusive. I think the problem here is that it's no longer the same problem that it was a year, 5 years, even 10 years ago. Ambassador Pickering was talking about the two articles, one by Brent Scowcroft, one by Henry Kissinger,
yes,
and the similarities. There actually is an important difference. One, it looks through the narrow end of the telescope, if you will, and says it's all about the Palestinian-Israeli question. Solve that.
That's Scowcroft.
That's right, Scowcroft. You have this cascading set of good things happening. You take the air out of radicalism and such like. Kissinger really takes it the opposite way, which says, look, you got a strategic problem here with Iran, and you have to think about all of these plays in the context of Iran's growing interest in dominating and also destabilizing the region. The important difference here from before is that you have this new militant, militarized Shia force, which now, in fact, operates outside the context of the Palestine-Israeli conflict, although they'd like to adopt part of that, and essentially puts an Iranian threat on Israel's border. Dealing with that, I will argue to you, is an imperative before you can get to the kind of peaceful situation or secure situation, not even peaceful, where we can then proceed on the diplomatic track.
But Thomas Pickering suggests we may have found ourselves in this situation because we weren't pushing that diplomatic track hard enough for the last few years. I want to let our callers into this conversation. Calling from Arlington, Virginia, Mahmoud is on the line. Hi, Mahmoud, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom. I just wanted to say, isn't it obvious to everybody that attacking civilians in Lebanon is going to give Iran and its Syrian proxies the propaganda they need to further defeat us psychologically in the Middle East? And you know, the only way that we're going to... It's like attacking Denmark in order to defeat Nazi Germany. I mean, all we're going to do is give the propaganda machinery a lot of dead children.
But I can say absolutely not everybody agrees with that. I mean, the other view is that you've got to show you're willing to do whatever it is against an opponent who lives among civilians, or else you're going to be seen as weak. What do you think?
Why not cut the head of the snake? You know, why not hand the mullahs over to the Iranian people who want a civil society? Otherwise, you know, we had attacked the wrong country. We attacked Iraq. We fell into a trap. Iran was everything we said Iraq was supposed to be. Iraq was manipulated by Iraq was being tortured by a government that was anti-religious. Iranians are being tortured by a government that's the headquarters of global terrorism. Even Chavez goes there to chant the mantra of death to America, which is their daily prayer every Friday.
But Lebanon is not the place to punch. Thomas Pickering, what about the propaganda battle here? Is that number one? Could we lose the region for decades as a result of images like this? Or the other view that's been put forward is you've got to show such toughness that you're willing to even take the kind of opprobrium that comes with these civilian deaths if you're going to be taken seriously as a foe.
Mahmoud is right in part, wrong on some colossal issues. He's right in the sense that our position in the region is declining. That's obvious. It's come as a result of a total focus in the Arab media on the destruction that's being caused in Lebanon, including the civilian deaths. He's wrong to say that those are the only civilian deaths. There have been some in Israel as well. There isn't a lot of sympathy for Israel in the region on this, and that won't work. The second point is that getting rid of the mullahs by putting them in the hands of the people is like saying, why don't we go into Iran just like we did in Iraq? And we've already, I think, learned a very important lesson there. Iran is many times the size of Iraq, and putting the mullahs in the hands of the people is not something that I think is within our capacity, militarily or otherwise.
A lot being learned about capacity right now. Thomas Pickering, Daniel Garay, please stand by. I want to welcome into our conversation, also from Washington, Jeremy Shapiro, fellow in foreign policy studies at the Brookings Institution, adjunct professor in security studies at Georgetown University. Jeremy Shapiro, thank you for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
So here, the American people are looking at these two views. One says, you know, go root and branch after this. This is the time. This is the chance to go all the way, clear out Hezbollah. Hezbollah must suffer a defeat here. On the other side, saying, you know, we're taking a beating in public perception that is going to, be a burden for decades on American foreign policy. We've got to have a ceasefire right now. How do you see it?
Well, I think how you see it depends on where you sit. And I think in some ways in this conversation, some of the confusion has been that there really is a distinction here between how what Israeli interests are and what American interests are. I think if you listen to Mr. Garay's description of the problem, it's very much how the Israelis would and should see it. They have this unacceptable threat on their border, and really only force will be able to deal with it because it is an implacable enemy which is not open to negotiation. The United States, however, has other fish to fry in the region. They are very involved in a lot of other places. They have an active insurgency in Iraq. They have a long-term program of Middle East democratization. Of course, there's the Iranian nuclear issue, which is very present. And it's clear that this war is setting back that problem. And so from the U.S. perspective, a ceasefire, I think, is very critical.
So that suggests that Israel and the U.S. have diametrically opposing interests right here, right now, on the ceasefire?
I think, yes, on the ceasefire they do. And I think that the United States government has been somewhat remiss in not quite understanding where the distinction is and following the Israelis too closely. For Condoleezza Rice to be very surprised and shocked by this atrocity, atrocity is perhaps the wrong word, but the casualties in Khana is appropriate, but one wonders why this should have been a surprise to her. In a war like this that lasts 2 or 3 weeks, one would expect an incident like this. And if the United States isn't prepared to deal with the propaganda fallout that comes from it, they should have been working toward putting a stop to it somewhat earlier.
Daniel Garay, the United States being pulled into a posture that fights maybe for Israel's immediate interests, but not for its own, not for American interests. What do you say to that?
Well, you know, the president in his statement with Tony Blair argued very differently. He said that this is the defining, if you will, clash of the 21st century, that we are, in effect, at war with radical Islam, and that while there are other interests, the paramount one, again, the administration argues, is, in fact, dealing with the threat of radicalism, and in related terms, radicals that acquire very dangerous technology. So he would argue, in fact, and seems to be behaving, as if Israel's war is part of America's war.
But do you win that bigger war with these images of civilian death all over the place and, you know, the sort of the image of the United States being the sponsor of a bully boy, critics would say?
Well, I mean, critics have said that no matter what Israel has done and no matter which war we are talking about, there's a more important issue here, which is I think what you're beginning to see, we're seeing it in Iraq, we're seeing it with Israel, is the failure of Western military power to successfully address this, they call it asymmetric, this insurgency threat, the terrorists embedded in civilian populations but owning advanced weaponry. And unless we figure out a different way, that is, for the next conflict, to deal with this, this is going to be the first of a series of victories for the insurgents, for the radicals.
Mm-hmm. Joe's calling from Washington. Hi, Joe. You're on the air.
Hey, Tom. Thanks a lot. I appreciate it.
Sure.
It's a fascinating discussion. And actually, to the point of a ceasefire, I think it's an interesting question to ask whether or not this administration, the President, Secretary Rice, would be able to even urge a ceasefire on Israel, considering the track record that they have. And just to wit, earlier in the conversation, with respect to this, and I call it a war crime at Khana, to imagine the effrontery. I mean, it's actually shocking to think that a U.S. Secretary of State would be in a meeting with a defense minister for Israel, and then all, before that, a foreign minister of Israel, and to have not been told about this atrocity, really. I mean, just separate from the moral outrage of the crime, just a diplomatic outrage that a U.S. Secretary of State might not have been told. It also, to me, underlies a sort of point about the dynamic of the relationship. How can the United States expect that our relationship could, you know, to me, it tells me something more about the relationship, that is it the cart pulling the horse here? I mean, are we really going to be telling Israel to stop its bombing?
Joe, let us pick it up. Ambassador Pickering, first, just address this issue, if you would, of the diplomatic significance of Condoleezza Rice sitting with the defense minister and not being told about Khanna. Understandable or outrageous, as Joe says?
I don't think it's understandable, but I don't think it's outrageous. Whether Amir Peretz and Tzipi Livni thought that Condoleezza Rice already knew about it and wasn't raising it, or whether they thought that the part of good diplomatic behavior was not to raise it, which I certainly totally disagree with, that was the situation. I don't think it's added to U.S. confidence in our relationship with Israel. One of those serious mistakes in diplomacy that shouldn't have been committed and should not be repeated.
Right now, Vahal is calling from Washington. Hi, Vahal, you're on the air.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I have a quick comment followed by a question. Iran is playing a very dangerous game here. Their allies in the Middle East are, on one hand, taking an entire region to war, that's Hezbollah, and their other allies, Nouri al-Maliki, is addressing the joint session here.
You're calling the head of Iraq an ally of Iran?
Is there a question about that? Absolutely. And my question is, how long until the international community does something about the root of this problem, Iran, and not subcontractors like Hezbollah, while at the same time killing civilians in Lebanon?
Let us pick that up. Yep, we've got it. Thank you for your call. Jeremy Shapiro, what about it? Everybody can see Iran's money that goes to Hezbollah, the arms that have gone to Hezbollah. So what's the effective response? To give Hezbollah a pounding in Lebanon, or to try and use this, as Brent Scowcroft says today, to sort of as an opportunity to get back on a peace track, which would undercut Iran, or to go straight at Iran?
Well, it's a difficult question, and I think the Iran is really at the center of this problem. I think in diplomacy, the two critical basic steps are to pick your battles and to try to pick apart the coalitions of your enemies. Right now, what we have is Iran has the capacity to use Hezbollah because the United States has not exploited the differences in the Middle East between these enemies, its various enemies. We see, as Dan Gray said, the Bush administration seems to have a view that they're facing a sort of monolithic foe, which is trying to fight the United States and Israel on all fronts. I think the Middle East is a very complicated place, and there's a lot of linkages between all these things. But in fact, there are a lot of differences between Iran and Syria and Hezbollah. And the United States would be wise to try to differentiate between them and try to split these coalitions so that they're not facing such an all-encompassing foe that can challenge U.S. interests on so many fronts.
Daniel Gray, how about it? Thomas Friedman in the New York Times, a columnist, wrote last week, "The world hates George Bush more than any U.S. president in my lifetime. He is radioactive and so caught up in his own ideological bubble that he is incapable of imagining or forging alternative strategies." Can this administration play the kind of nuanced game that Jeremy Shapiro is talking about there, to pick apart an alliance of foes?
Well, I'm not sure it is all that nuanced, if we use Friedman's language, to go running to Syria to beg them to pull ours or the Israelis or the world's chestnuts out of any fire a year after or so after having driven them out of Lebanon. And in fact, one has to wonder if that isn't exactly what Syria's game is, and going to Syria would be very much a matter of giving them exactly what they want. I mean, there's a difference between nuance and foolishness, and some of these efforts that have been proposed by various people border, I think, on that.
Thomas Pickering, you know the charge. The diplomats have had this in their quarter for how many decades now and haven't worked it out. It's time for rougher stuff, and there's no choice, really, because the rockets are right there. What do you say?
Well, I think if you believe that Iraq is a howling success and that it proves that military action can solve all of your problems, go to it. I don't have to see it that way, and I do see at the end of every one of these conflicts the need to have effective diplomacy. I think that Professor Shapiro is right, that there are diplomatic openings here that can be picked apart. I think talking to Damascus is not sucking up to them. Talking to Damascus is just telling them that if they don't play their role in cleaning up this problem, what came before is going to be a lot worse for them in the way of isolation and inability to perform in the world community on which they depend as much as anybody else. I think much the same can be said by a previous caller who pointed out that Iran is at the heart of a lot of this, that Iran is, in fact, isolating itself very rapidly from the world community, that what Hezbollah has done has not endeared Iran to the rest of the Sunni Arab world, certainly, and has raised real questions, I think, among some Shia in many places. And this needs to be used as points of leverage to have an effective diplomacy, to work first toward the priority of a goal of denuclearizing Iran, solving, as Brent Scowcroft has written, the Palestinian-Israeli conflict, and bringing about a ceasefire, as tentative as that's likely to be in a short term in Lebanon. To the extent that we can do that, we have to, as a government, begin to do something governments haven't done very well in the past, walk and chew gum.
Well, Ambassador, let me ask you, if I may, you worked for George Bush Sr. Now, Tom Friedman says George Bush is more Jr. is more hated than any other U.S. president in his lifetime. He's radioactive, incapable of imagining or forging alternative strategy. Is it possible that the U.S. just simply can't play the role that everybody says is vital because of its record of the last few years in this region?
I don't think that that is a permanent decapitation, because in the long run, everybody knows that the U.S. is still the essential critical player. And if you go and talk to Arabs, despite what the public thinks in the streets and despite what is essentially a very negative view of the United States, they also know that we play and still play an essential role in the region built up over 30 years.
Let me go to my caller, Ray, from Houston, Texas. Hi, Ray, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom. I appreciate the forum, as usual. I'm frustrated as a U.S. citizen by our country's diplomacy. I'm reminded of the quote that experts built the Titanic, novices built the built Noah's Ark. What I'm trying to understand here is this is not the first Arab-Israeli war. Hopefully it's the last, but unlikely. We've been in these situations before as a country. From a diplomatic standpoint, this is the first time that I can recall that we've been engaged in a war in the region. And I feel that as a country, we've built enough goodwill with Israel over the years that we don't need to be so lavishly outpouring in our support for them. Don't we have enough goodwill built up in our relationship that now that the world is seeing us so openly one-sided in this argument, that it could serve to undermine our position in Iraq?
But Ray, in Iraq, okay. But let me ask you. Dan Garay says, you know, there's a war with Islamofascism here, and the U.S. and Israel are on the same side. It's not a matter of reining in somebody that's out of line. Israel's fighting our fight, he says.
A couple of points there. That's a great point. But, you know, I wonder about that because men like Begin and George Washington perhaps were considered extremists and terrorists in their time. That's point one. Point number two is you can't change a person's religion, but you can change their politics. And our government has served for so long to undermine the true democratic processes in this country is that when groups like the PLO are undermined severely, you're going to give birth to organizations that are more extreme because the secularists have not delivered.
Let us pick it up. Jeremy Shapiro, do you see the U.S. effort in Iraq undermined by the fallout from this fighting right now?
Yeah, and I think anything that undermines the U.S. standing in the region will make an already extremely difficult situation in Iraq harder. We've had we've already seen attention being diverted away from it at the same time that we are at a critical point in Iraq. We've seen the relations between the U.S. government and the new Iraqi government strained by this crisis. It is certainly at a time of very difficult U.S. action in the region, not just in Iraq, but in many other places. This is a crisis that the United States clearly did not need.
But Israel is an old ally. Is there an option? You know, Ray in Houston is suggesting, you know, don't have too thick of kid gloves here. Go to Israel and say, well, say what, Jeremy Shapiro? I mean, the rockets are falling on Israel. So what might be asked of Israel that hasn't been asked before that might provide a breakthrough here? Is there something, some magic word?
Well, I think one of the things that can be done is not so much reining in Israel, but accepting that there is a distinction between what Israel wants to do and what the United States wants to do. Part of the problem has been that the United States has been seen too much in Israel's corner, and that actually I don't think has helped either the United States or Israel. Clearly, Israel has the right to defend itself, and clearly I think that Mr. Goray is right when he says that really dealing with Hezbollah certainly requires, at the very least, a demonstration of force, a demonstration of will to show that you are not afraid of it. But Hezbollah is a different problem for Israel than it is for the United States. And so separating ourselves a little from this, demonstrating that we understand that Israel has legitimate interests, but they're not ours, and then coming in at a certain point and saying, look, this has gone too far. This is starting to affect the wider region and other people, and we need to put a stop to it, would have given the United States a lot more credibility.
But how do you separate the United States from that interest? I mean, we're major supporters of Israel in many ways. The laser-guided bombs were rushed there. If the U.S. steps back from Israel and Israel pursues what you identify as its interests here in going after Hezbollah, the U.S. has no role to play in that.
That's not true. I think Israel, the United States has a lot of influence over Israel, but when it comes to Israel's most vital interest, Israel will do what Israel will do, as is appropriate. And sometimes the United States has, by failing to criticize that, put up into the minds of people in the region and, frankly, people here in the United States, that our interests are exactly identical. The fact that that Israel might be doing something the United States doesn't want doesn't mean that we don't have any influence or that our relationship isn't good, but it does mean that we should be seen as distinct actors which have distinct interests and that others should be able to identify the distinctions.
The president has been speaking about these very issues this morning in Miami at the U.S. Coast Guard Integrated Support Command. He said in a speech there that he would seek U.N. action on ending the fighting in southern Lebanon this week, but he resisted again an immediate ceasefire. He spoke about the role of the U.S. and its allies.
We're determined to deliver relief to those who suffer. We're determined to work to resolve this crisis. To achieve the peace that we want, we must achieve certain clear objectives. Lebanon's democratic government must be empowered to exercise sole authority over its territory. A multinational force must be dispatched to Lebanon quickly so we can help speed the delivery of humanitarian aid to the Lebanese people. Iran must end its financial support and supply of weapons to terrorist groups like Hezbollah. Syria must end its support for terror and respect the sovereignty of Lebanon. This approach will make it possible what so many around the world want to see: the end of Hezbollah's attacks on Israel, the return of the Israeli soldiers taken hostage by the terrorists, the suspension of Israel's operations in Lebanon, and the eventual withdrawal of Israeli forces.
Lots of musts being handed down there by the President of the United States in Miami this morning. Must this, must that. But what should the U.S. really push to make happen? What can it push to make happen? Tim is calling from Iowa City, Iowa. Hi, Tim. You're on the air.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Yeah. What do you think, Tim?
I guess one of the points that I'd like maybe your guest to address is the idea that Israel really doesn't have any options right now. It's running up against Hezbollah, which has put up more resistance than any of the other enemies it's faced. And it needs to basically wipe Hezbollah off the map, and that's why you're probably going to see more incursions into Lebanon to take care of that threat.
I'll put that to my guest. Let me ask you, Tim. Jeremy Shapiro says perhaps so, but this is not necessarily an interest shared by the United States. So what should the U.S. do?
Well, I don't know if the U.S. has that much that it can do. I think Israel, you know, needs to show that it can You know, yesterday you saw more rockets launched into Israel than
150 on Sunday. No diminution there, though it's off some today.
Right, and so Israel needs to be able to basically show that it can take care of any threat, you know, along its borders, and it hasn't done so yet.
Ambassador Pickering, you were ambassador to Israel. This is seen by many there as an existential threat, and the belief we see is riding high that they have got to go in and give Hezbollah a thumping, and many are saying they have not done that. Daniel Goray is saying, you know, Western military power, Israeli military power, not exactly showing itself terribly successful so far. What about the argument that Israel has to go in and take care of Hezbollah here? It's an existential threat, Ambassador.
Well, Tom, to keep the record straight, I was also ambassador to Jordan. Let me make the following point. Israel has not shown yet the capacity to deal with Hezbollah. And my conclusion, which I gave you at the beginning, was this represents a declining Israeli military capability rather than a rising one. That, in effect, we have given them as much of a window of opportunity as we can, consistent with the political circumstances. The effort has been, since Secretary Rice first went to the area, it was inevitable that we would be caught up in a ceasefire. We are now. The president has said that. I like all the president's conditions, but they're not going to all be achieved at one time. There will be an effort to advance the ceasefire, perhaps in connection with some of those conditions. One would like to see a U.N. force that can keep Hezbollah off Israel's back, if that's possible. I have my doubts that that's a permanent condition. The permanent condition needs to be dealt with, and those are the two permanent conditions that I highlighted at the beginning, that we have to also find a way to deal with Iran's nuclear program, and we have to find a way to deal with the stalled, the absolutely grounded process of Israeli-Palestinian peace.
That's a big agenda, but the stakes are big. Daniel Goray, it looks like the last word's going to go to you here. There will be a push on the diplomatic front this week. Do you think that will ultimately be successful, or is this still about military power, even the military power with its failings that you've pointed out?
Well, what I think is going to happen is that it is going to become increasingly difficult for Israel and perhaps the United States to address the kind of asymmetric threat that Hezbollah and its ilk demonstrate without being willing to put large ground forces into combat and sustain, not only mete out, but sustain heavy casualties.
U.S. forces in Lebanon, are you saying that?
Well, not at this particular point, but I'm saying in general, the cases. We and they are in a casualty avoidance mode. We've been that way for most of the Iraq War and its aftermath, and the Israelis are clearly in that mode, in which case the terrorists win. The net result of that will be eventually, and you've heard it in this conversation, that the only place the U.S. can put pressure on anybody to change the Middle East situation is to actually put pressure on Israel. And ultimately, Israel, I guess, gets thrown to the wolves down the road, forced to essentially make the concessions that lead to peace.
One wonders, but there's the range of views, and I'm very grateful to each of you for being with us today. Daniel Goray at the Lexington Institute, thank you very much for your time. Thank you for joining us.
You're very welcome.
Jeremy Shapiro, fellow in foreign policy studies at the Brookings Institution. Jeremy Shapiro, thank you for being with us.
Thanks for having me.
And Ambassador Thomas Pickering, former U.S. Ambassador to the United Nations, former Undersecretary of State for Political Affairs, and Ambassador in Israel, Jordan, India, El Salvador. Ambassador, thank you for joining us.
Thank you, Tom. It's a pleasure to be with you.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.